Actually, I'm really delighted to have the opportunity. Can you hear me or should I use this? The first dilemma for me is I almost never do presentations in my seat. I can't sit. And so I usually am up walking and talking. But I'm going to start in my seat. I can't tell you I'll end in my seat. But, you know, I got to get myself focused. Let me tell you a little bit about this presentation. This has been a fun and exciting time. I did the pre-symposium group, and it was a wonderful group, and we just kind of engaged around the subject matter, and I felt myself really back in a place where I have the joy of learning and thinking about topics that I feel like I'm breaking edges with. I want to tell you the background for this presentation and then tell you exactly how I'm going to approach it, which is a little bit different. This is a work in progress. I have been spending a lot of my professional life in the last 15, 20 years in organizations that break out of the normal patterns. I, for some reason, have found myself enjoying working in systems that were often in serious trouble. I call them broken, sometimes wounded systems. I think I got that from my early work with adolescents, in which there just was no room to get forgiven or understood about anything. You know, you roll your eyes wrong and they're all over you. But they taught you a lot. They taught you to have a lot of respect for emotions in relationships. They taught you to not get arrogant about what you thought you knew, because adolescents have a wonderful way of saying, oh, let me check that out. And so I think those early day experiences really got me excited about seeing what happens with adults in organizations. So I mysteriously found myself working in a lot of those systems. And it was over the years that I began to notice and pay some attention to some of what I was doing and why it was working, when I was often coming in behind consultants that they'd thrown out and chased out. And I said, oh, my goodness, this is not going to be a fun place. And then it turned out to be a fun place. So I had to ask myself, what was it that, you know, myself and my team were often doing that made a difference? And so I then decided I needed to write more about it. About 20 years ago, I wrote The Casualty Syndrome, in which I looked at the first organization that really pushed the edges, but I was also the head of the clinical system of that system, so I was both looking at the organization at myself. But I then finally got around to writing about wounded systems and the role of leadership in making an impact on them. And I ended up really taking some of my toughest and meanest cases and looking at what happens when people are wounded in a way that traditional interventions just don't seem to work. You cannot go in and talk to them. They don't respond to linear and rational interventions. They're not interested. It's almost like you have adults, but they behave like children. And so you have to do something different. And so I started looking at what we were doing and why some of the things worked and why they didn't work. So the presentation this morning is about those kinds of systems. Even more important is the shift that I started to make was that I became aware that as we started looking at trauma as a concept, you know, we were seeing traumatized people. But what we began to discover is that treating traumatized people in an organization wasn't always very effective, and it started to become clear that there was something else going on. So the shortcut for that was we began to think that the trauma is in the system. How is it in the system? What does it look like? We know what it looks like with people, but we weren't paying a lot of attention to what does it look like when it gets in the organizational structures. So this is a work in progress. I think I have a lot of insights about it. I think we've had a lot of successes with it, but I'm still on a learning journey about it. And so some of the cases that I'm going to talk about, you'll hear the unfinished part of the journey. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my thinking on the front end and put it into a context. And then the rest of the presentation, I'm going to take you through three or four of the cases and talk about the experience inside. And then stop and see what you think. So, this paper is an attempt to examine the process by which the disturbed, unbalanced, or troubled organization becomes stuck in their dysfunctional patterns, and the challenge of leaders and managers to intervene into the system, move it back to a more healthy operational process. It looks at how the basic trauma cycle in individuals can duplicate itself at the organizational level and hold the system hostage if the only interventions are at the symptom level, i.e. the individual reactions to a wounded organization or environment. So that if you only get the people to change, the system tends to keep on doing what it does. And what you then see is that staff and faculty, and if you look at it, corporations, the same thing happens, just happens in a different way. People come in and there's a root and they're out just as fast. And even if you fix a few of them very effectively, if you haven't impacted the cycle or the structures that keep creating it, that's what we would begin to deal with. Sandra Bloom, who developed the sanctuary model, wrote that organizations, like individuals, can be traumatized, and the result of the traumatic experience can be as devastating for organizations as for individuals. Just as the encroachment of trauma into the life of an individual client sets off an insidious process that turns the past into a nightmare, the present into a repetitive cycle of reenactment, and the future into a terminal illness, so too the impact of chronic strain on an organization is insidious. As seemingly logical reactions to difficult situations pile up upon each other, no one is able to truly perceive the fundamentally skewed and past traumatic basic assumption upon which that logic is built. Just as an earthquake can cause the foundations of a building to become unstable, even while the building still stands, apparently intact, so too does chronic repetitive stress or sudden traumatic stress destabilize the cognitive and affective foundations of shared meaning that is necessary for a group to function and stay whole. So it is easy to see the link between organizations in the world of mental health being caught up and at times overwhelmed by the stress of servicing the client systems with whom they work. However, the patterns and phases where interventions need to occur, perhaps even more critically, are places that would like to see themselves as normal and not particularly troubled. This is the place where we started seeing public systems and corporations, and they are in another world. They don't see it until it's in their face and it affects their service, their delivery systems. Yet it is often these organizations, it's often in these organizations where some of the pernicious violations of people's human rights and are neglected and occur. We see them, for example, in organizations where the desire to win the battle has developed patterns and assumptions that are brutal, toxic, violating of other individuals with seemingly no concern for social justice principles. In schools where teachers are poorly trained and left to their own survival skills in the classroom, with youth, many of whom themselves have been abused by adults, or in corporations where men and women exploit each other and play power games to win the advantage. We will attempt to show how the trauma pattern duplicates itself in organizational life and look at the roles and responsibilities of leadership to manage and correct the anomalies that often go unnoticed until individuals show stress symptoms from the accumulated strain. So I want to, just as a reminder, just say something about something that a lot of you are probably familiar with, but just as a framework, so that when I start talking about its link in the organizations, I'll have already said what my assumptions I'm working off of. The trauma symptoms in individual are simple for us to hold on to. I'm not going to try and take you into all of those variations on the brain functioning and cycles. Basically, I want to talk about four patterns and then show you the sort of the advance or the continuation of those patterns in individuals. So the first is the stage of what they called hyperarousal, which you get an increase in heart rate, you get difficult breathing, you get muscle tension, tightness, sometimes cold sweats. But hyperarousal is just that. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about thinking about trauma is that the literature talks about it, and the experience you see is that it's a survival process that the brain goes through. Makes sense. Protects people from getting more damage from a situation that's out of their control. So hyperarousal, you get alerted to something. The second stage we talk about is constriction, in which there's a lot of tension and holding on or contraction. When the body is in contracted state, it doesn't let some things in. It definitely doesn't let some things out. It sort of holds it. When it's held in the musculature, that means it can be released at any particular time. You don't know when, or where, or how. The third state is dissociative, in which there's a loss of memory, there's a disconnect, and it protects us from having to experience the pain or live with something that may be less than tolerable, and gives people a way out. The problem is that it's a functional survival mechanism until it starts getting used in systems where its functionality loses meaning. And then freezing or immobility associated with feeling helpless. Those are just the four basic stages which everybody is often very familiar with. But then they go on to say that there are other things that can be stimulated and set off. And I'm going to touch on some of those because they're related to some of these cases that you're about to hear. So, hyperarousal moves on to hypervigilance, which is then being on guard at all times. And so, one of the ones we see a lot of is hypervigilance. After people have been aroused and stimulated by, violations or abuses, they're on guard. They don't trust. Intrusive imagery or flashbacks, hyperactivity, abrupt mood swings, temper tantrums, shame, reduced ability to deal with stress, amnesia, forgetful, taking unnecessary risks, avoidance behavior, mental spaciness, frequently stressed out, frequently crying, chronic fatigue, difficulty in planning and focusing. That was a very interesting big one. And some of those are on the PowerPoint. I was just moving through them. I'll let you see it. This is Bloom's statement about crisis-driven organizations, which I think is the one that, you know, sort of says it. She really capsulizes it. That what happens is they sacrifice communication networks, so your communication systems go down. Feedback loops are gone. Participatory decision-making doesn't happen. Can't tolerate it. Doing complex problem solving tends to be gone by the time you get there. There's chronic stress in the system. People give up. First thing that goes is democratic processes, because what people are more concerned about, particularly the hierarchy, is staying in control. They know the system is fragile or vulnerable, so they go for control. And therefore, you get increasingly hierarchical, top-down control structures that discourage creativity. What you're looking at is one of the pieces that came from one of the organizations I'm going to talk about. In this organization, we walked in and asked the management, so tell us what it is that's going on under the table. We didn't ask them for what do you see that's going on. Never ask the stress system a straight-up question, because you will not get a straight-up answer. Since the stress is in the emotional system, people are busy distorting or giving answers that either they think will please you, so you ask them a question that gets a little closer to their own experience. So you ask them, what is it that can't be talked about in this organization? What's under the table? These were some of the things we got in this system, and I thought it kind of represented a pattern that you see a lot of. Look at the first one. One of the basic issues in highly stressed systems is that people don't feel safe. Translation, the system doesn't feel safe. Now, that, for me, is one of the ones that has one of the most impact on anybody going to intervene in it. Because if the intervener cannot create a sense of safety, they will not give you anything. You know, you just become another part of one of the entities that are a potential threat. And usually, in my experience, by the time I've gotten in, they've chased two or three consultants out of there. So they also have a track record and see themselves as the way to be controlled, like kids who raised in hell in a facility. You know, we kicked out the last two, three people. You know, you're going out too. Hell of a way to come in, isn't it? Inconsistent standards between staff and management. Always a breakdown at the communication level between the top and the next levels down. You'll see that in almost every one of the cases that I'm going over. Lack of trust, I don't have to speak to. Inconsistent accountability structures. Half the time, there's no accountability structure. One of my favorite articles about blame versus accountability really speaks to it. Blame is what you see. They're looking for somebody to say, has made my life or this what goes on here miserable. And accountability doesn't happen, because in order to be accountable, you got to have a little trust somewhere. There's no clear expectations. Almost always, there's an imbalance in relationships between men and women, and it can't be talked about. And, of course, in most cases, the women are feeling like they're on the downside of the deal, and the men are in denial. One error overshadows a lifetime of successes. I thought that was interesting. What they were saying was nobody sees our good. All they see is what we do wrong, and then we get punished for it. Poor morale, no direction. In every case, you almost can predict that when the system is that chaotic and feeling that wounded or violated, there is no clear sense of where we're going. Because if there was a path that said this is how we're going to get out of here, You'll hear that in one of the cases. They'd have hope, but when there is no sense of where we're going, the other thing you're up against is hope is halfway gone, and that also produces the no morale. And then fear to manage or discipline staff. The managers did this. And in that system, which was a union-driven system in education, the managers were afraid to manage. And literally, they were afraid to manage. They were afraid if they managed, nobody would back them up, and that the union was the powerful force, and they'd get killed. Even worse in that system, as you'll hear, they didn't train managers. I kid you not, that system, you couldn't find management training. A 20-year history, there was no management training. Didn't even know what it was. And didn't want to say it. And the way they got managers was through the who knows who system. I don't know where they found some of those people. But it sure wasn't much management going on. And the failure to share information. You know, those kinds of system, information is power. That's what they do with it. So that was the beginning. And this is the what you just heard me talk about. Those are the four systems. That's the one that I talked about. And what's fascinating about some of this is that you see it in people. But when you see it in the organization, it takes a different form. And when you see it running rampant, and people are tired in these systems, and they'll say, we're overworked. But if you change the work hours, people are still tired. They're tired because the emotional energy is all tied up in that tension and in holding the space between their own emotional vulnerability and what they see as a hostile environment. So, the other quick piece here is that a lot of these systems would call you in because they wanted to change something. They wanted to change what was happening. So, I like to tell you what my quick thinking is about change, because it's the frame that I use. That change is really something's got to end. And something new has to begin. Well, if something doesn't end, there's no newness that's going to take place. So if you go in and buy the task, we're going to fix and make this right and do something correct, and you don't do the ending work, you'll be there the rest of your life, and nothing will change. So you've got to really take on the task of ending something and know what you've got to end in order for something else to get in there. Yeah, it's like, like cleaning out your closet. You've got those old clothes. If you don't clean them out, never put anything else in there. No room. And then anxiety does accompany this process, moving people out of their comfort zones. The other thing is that change causes losses. And so a whole bunch is up. Now, people are already vulnerable. And now you're coming in and saying, you know, what you were comfortable with, as terrible as it was, you got to give up because we're going to do something that we think is going to be better for you. And, you know, in ideal world, you'd say, they should be happy about this. They should be appreciative that something is going to... Are you kidding me? That's not where people go. It's an intellectual concept until they get an emotional context that they can hold. They don't take you seriously. So change is about all of these things having to, be changed. And, I'm going the wrong way. See? I'm still going the wrong way. Okay. All right, I'm going to leave that there so we can come back to that. But this is the beginning of what you're beginning to see, that when the system is in trouble, your management system is useful. And this is what happens to managers when they're under stress. So one of the first things you see if you're starting at the leadership level, one of the first experiences we have is that the managers start behaving strangely. When they are under stress, they become dysfunctional for all these reasons. They misperceive information, they can't focus. You have managers that can't get a job done. You keep giving it to them, and they find all kinds of ways to get around it. And I'll show you that the tactics for getting around it at the management level is really profound. They take it to another level. They get fixed on single problems so that the system, the complexity, can't get addressed. So your management team can't function. It took me 2 years to get a senior management team to act like they were senior managers. 2 years. And that's going in almost every other week. The resistance is incredible. They overestimate how fast time is passing, and they always feel rushed. Adopt a short-term perspective around crises. Don't make fine distinctions very well. Consult with and listen to others less. You know, what happens when you're frightened is you fall back on that which you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. And that's what they do. So, I'm going to leave that one up there and take you through the first case. Now, I've done something interesting. Three of the cases are, you know, written out, and they're taken from an article that we wrote about. But one of the cases, I decided to let you hear what we did, what we saw going in, and the patterns. Because one of the things that I think really helps to figure out where the stress or the trauma is in the system is you have to track patterns. And so, this was an agency that was busy growing. It's out in the Midwest, and they owned a health and a mental health system. They owned a small real estate system. They were building a grocery store, a supermarket in the area. They were really growing. But they were on the edge of a crisis. And the first symptom had been that the exec had gotten really thoroughly pissed off with his senior management. And a former colleague of mine was in that group. And he had given them an assignment, and nobody remembered. Do you hear me? Nobody remembered what he had asked. And he was undone. And he had a habit of having tantrums. So he had a tantrum and was threatening to punish everybody. I wanted to know somebody should have been able to remember what he had given them. So my colleague called me and said, "Do you want a consultation job?" I said, "Tell me what it is first." And so she described it. I said, "Oh, that sounds interesting." And so I went. And one of my keys is whether I'll stay or not is whether I can work with the exec. Because if I can't, don't ever go into a place trying to do work that's serious with a system, and you don't have a relationship with the exec, you don't have anything to work with because that's the only person who's got your back. I'll say more about that. And this was after we worked with the executive group, and it was up and down. They get a little bit and they get out. But this document, which was done when we were maybe a year and a half in there, really gives you the patterns, because we have a way of going back, get the team back and say, what are the patterns we are seeing? Because once we're down in there, the risk is getting stuck and keep trying to fix a repetitive thing that you can't get the meaning of. And so unless I've learned to pull my team out, sit still, and we go down and say, what are we seeing? What is going on? What are the patterns? It takes us a while to do it, because we really have to, you know, push against each other. I went to a presentation that Mary McCray and her crew did, and they were talking about, you know, going back and looking at stuff the second and the third time. I said, yeah, because every time you have to look at it, you see something you couldn't see the first time. You get a half a step out, half a step away, and all of a sudden the picture changes. So in this case, this is the key stuff that the team pointed to. Some of the assumptions, and we wrote it as patterns and assumptions. One was, I know I'm right, but what's wrong with you? Takes the form of finger pointing, blaming everyone, anyone other than self. Generates isolating behavior, no accountability. Does not acknowledge the need for new skills on the part of all the key managers. No, we don't need anything. Second set, talking cooperation while staying separate. Difficult to break silo mentality because each executive already operates fiefdoms and they weren't giving it up. They are threatened by change, but that is expressed covertly. And lastly, they say they don't like silos, but they behave like they'd rather be left alone. What we found is that the silo game was a real major protection for senior managers. It gives them a place where they can feel like what they're doing has meaning and value and purpose, but they do not communicate across their area of specialty. And if you ask them about it, they'll say, oh, we're doing that. We talked to each other. We had a meeting the other day and we did this and that. But they're not talking to each other. The way I found out very painfully was early on in, I think I'd been there about 6 or 8 months, and the exec decided he needed to leave town and asked me to do a piece of work that I was doing with the team while he was gone. So I said, oh, sure, no problem. I got killed. They beat me up from the time I walked in there. And the issue was that they associated me as being part of the exec. And all the issues that they wouldn't give him, they gave me. Now, one of the things I know about this work is that I have learned from experience. You know, I said, well, I don't need to take any more whippings like that. That was very painful. And what I discovered is, that's why I got clear that if you don't have the exec at your back, that there was nobody to talk to. And they were all very self-righteous in their areas, and they talk at each other, not to each other, not with each other. And it's like listening to the chatter of people talking at each other and you being in the middle of it, like in a cage, and nothing you say gets heard because you got to get across everybody's territory. It's a very painful experience. The third set we tracked was paralysis of executive leadership. And pattern, we said, can't put energy in opposite places at the same time, so the resistance is covert. What that means is that they can't speak their disagreement. So you can put energy over here when you really disagree, when you're supposed to be doing a job over here and that you're supposed to be talking about how what you're doing and they're doing is connected. So the disagreements are covert, and they don't get raised to the surface. And so you have this as if they're talking to each other when they're talking about each other, and nobody's tracking it. And this is a good example of trauma in the system. They'll have a meeting, and they'll talk across, talk at each other. A lot of profound things go back and forth. Nobody tracks it, and nobody remembers what they did. So a week later, same issue can be on the table. And then they point fingers and say, who didn't do that? But nobody can prove who did or didn't do it because there's nobody tracking anything. It's profound. And then if you're the visitor, they then team up to make you look like you really don't know what you're doing. This one we found very funny. The price they pay for this behavior is that they cannot be expansive, they won't grow, And so that leadership team acts like a contracted, depressed group. No surprise. The third one was they use consultants as a distraction. They don't use the information or the input, so it accumulates and repeats itself. It's like consulting to the wall. And they dance with it. They do give you just enough to make you think that what you had to say had some value, and then it disappears down a dark hole. And then, because you were there and you had a job to do something and make something happen, they blame you. And that was a nonprofit company, but I had the same experience, which I didn't understand quite as well at the time. I did work with AT&T Capital, and we had the exact same experience. The senior managers refused. They had asked, they were doing downsizing and they were doing flattening the organization, but the senior managers were never available to be at a meeting. They had laid out the paperwork, signed it, were retraining the middle management, but they were never there. So when the middle managers had a problem or made a mistake, senior managers all got together and say, well, you don't know what you're doing. And they point fingers and blame. It was profound. And the mistake we made was we pushed and pushed. And then two of us finally got up to talk to the senior managers. And the same experience of getting beat up. Don't listen to you, blame you for everything. And at that point, you know, what I know now is if I'd seen that behavior, I'd know I have a traumatized system. You don't go up there and have a meeting because there's no, it's not going to go anywhere. There's no place to have a meeting. There's no meeting to have. You're up against emotional resistance, and it's really hard to break. And the third piece of this is the group operates at a level of complaint and blaming, and it's been there for a long, long time. And the missing ingredient is the capacity to be fully present, to bring any vulnerability or awareness or strengths or passion or openness or self-confidence to the table. Listen to that. Those are all emotional resources. Don't bring any of that to the table, along with your capacity to act and get the job done, learn new skills, and apply. So when there's a split between the emotional pieces and the intellectual rationale, it's hard to shift it. Really hard to shift it. Okay. I'm going to read you one more case and then go into some of the material on the PowerPoint. The second case is the case of Mary Jo, which was done in a large metropolitan mental health and health facility on the East Coast. Mary Jo was a white senior manager in a largely black urban municipal organization. She got along well with most of her colleagues and was known to be fair and very supportive of her direct reports, most of whom were African Americans in mid-level management positions. Phyllis, an African-American woman who came from another part of the agency to work for Mary Jo, while enthusiastic, initially, Phyllis developed a pattern of avoiding technical work that was clearly a requirement of her job. Mary Jo was often out of the office and did much of her work in the evening after Phyllis had gone home. Mary Jo knew she needed to confront Phyllis directly about work that was sliding, but there never seemed to be time. Eventually, she went to the human resources office for consultation, and when the evidence was reviewed, was told to initiate a performance management plan with Phyllis. After the first meeting, Phyllis realized Mary Jo was serious. She became angry. Their previously harmonious relationship became fractured and contentious. Phyllis insisted that Mary Jo document all communication with her and the human resources officer with whom Phyllis consulted agreed that was reasonable. The conversation, the documentation, and the acrimony persisted for several more weeks until Mary Jo overheard whispers at the coffee machine and realized that the situation had escalated. Phyllis had filed an EEO suit against Mary Jo, claiming that she was discriminating against Phyllis as a minority and a mother. Mary Jo was childless. Once the grievance was filed, communications concerning it was taken out of Mary Jo's hands by her supervisor, who conducted all meetings with human resource personnel about how action would proceed. No one met with Mary Jo until she demanded information about what was transpiring. No one in human resources acknowledged or addressed the fact that the issue was initially about whether Phyllis's skill sets were sufficient for the role, or that human resources had consulted with Mary Jo, advised that a performance management plan be effectuated, and approved the plan that Mary Jo developed. The issue went from competence to color, effectuated and approved the plan that Mary Jo developed. From competence to color, as soon as the discrimination claim was filed. Phyllis was allowed to transfer to another department, taking her budgeted slot with her, and Mary Jo lost a critical position within our division. Anybody want to talk about what you heard in that? Don't all speak at once.
I heard an avoidance at the end of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be a real fear about racial stuff going on. And, you know, and a real refusal to kind of look at that as, you know, and talk about racial stuff that's going on, and kind of such a fear of it that, you know, creates chaos instead of sanity.
Sounds like they don't have an effective system for supervision and evaluation, that this only comes up when there's a problem, and that so there were not systematic evaluations, systematic plans for criteria for evaluation and the like, so that it allowed the situation to get loaded after it was already a significant problem.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about scapegoating earlier, and it sounds like it was a prime example of a scapegoat.
Absolutely. And one of the things that happens in a system that's really traumatizing their structures is that the structures often aren't in place that manage any boundaries. So the moment an issue raises to the level of a serious push, it gets personal, and there's no structures in place to manage it. And so somebody has to get scapegoated. Somebody gets blamed. So in this case, the manager who did what human resources told her to do was the one that got caught.
Mm-hmm. It seems like she should have been working more closely with Phyllis to begin with, and, you know, going over standards, expectations, holding her accountable. You know, rather than, it sounds like it waited a while, she didn't have the time to do it, and then, you know, came in perhaps more heavy-handed.
Well, I think in this case, she, you know, her not having the time disallowed her to see what was starting to happen, because she did do everything that human resources, she went to human resources early and said, I don't know what's the best way to handle this. And they said, this is the best way to handle it. She did everything she was supposed to do. She did the meetings and so forth. But what happened was when Phyllis picked up that this was serious and that she wasn't going to get away with it, now what you're hearing is in this system, people usually get away. And particularly, race is a way they got away. All the people had to do was call the race car, and they could usually ease out. Well, it didn't look like she was going to get to ease out around in the initial stage, so she took it to another level. And then it got personal. Got to be that this person is blaming me because she doesn't appreciate my dilemma as a parent, and because she doesn't have any children. What kind of foolishness is that, do you think? But the reason it can work is there are no structures in place. And so staff know that, and so they go to the edge.
Can you help us understand, what do you mean there are no structures in place?
There are no accountability structures in place. And you can have the rules, but if nobody's held accountable when it comes time to enforce them, what good does it do?
So Phyllis was being held accountable
by her supervisor.
By her supervisor.
By her manager.
But not by everyone else.
Well, when she pushed it and said, no, this is not about my competence, this is about personal stuff, the system folded. That's what happened.
Can you say something about the structures that were not set in place so that Mary Jo didn't overlap in terms of work time with those?
Well,
Repeat the question,
so she can hear.
Looking at the supervisor's collusion in being set up, the data that I heard was that her work schedule did not overlap with the person that she was supervising. So I'm wondering, what were the systemic characteristics that set up Mary Jo, and what was Mary Jo's collusion in terms of having these hours? There must be some meaning to that.
The hour discrepancy went on in the front end. When she went to HR, that got corrected immediately. She began to have the meetings consistently, you know, within the boundaries. So that only, she just didn't catch the slippage because of the hour crossover. She didn't catch the slippage. When she finally became aware of how much slippage there was, that's when she shifted.
It sounds to me like there's something more going on. It sounds to me like there's something missing.
No, I was in there. First of all, you see, this is a good example. No, that's a great question. This is a good example. See, what we want to do, what we tend to do is say, there's got to be a person issue in here. I can give you 5 or 6 examples of the same dynamic in that system in which the structures weren't in place. So the manager is the one that gets screwed. So what the managers learn to do is keep your head down and don't push. You transfer that person out and get rid of them. Find some way to get rid of them, dump them off on somebody else so that you don't have to deal with it. And then that gets to be the pattern in the system. So if you're coming in to be a consultant, you need to look at the patterns in the system before you start deciding to go intervene, because you'll intervene with a person because that's the person becomes the immediate symptom. But after a while, you notice that those symptoms are popping up like popcorn everywhere around the system, so that something's broken in the infrastructure patterns.
I want to be clear. I'm agreeing with you.
I know.
Okay. So the schedule becomes a way of avoiding.
Yes.
So the schedule difference was actually a solution to the problem, because it wasn't permissible for there to be any engagement around the issue of race.
No, we're not saying the same thing.
Okay.
The schedule shouldn't have been an issue. If you're a manager of a larger system, you have employees that cross over your time. You're not necessarily keeping everybody's. So the employee is, some of your employees can move across your time zone. That's not the problem. She said that's what allowed her to not see it as fast as she thought she should have. But she saw it in time to correct it if the system was working with her. That's what you're hearing. So I'm not disagreeing with you that, you know, but the missing wasn't about missing what the work was.
Sounds very familiar. And so I just want to acknowledge that. What I'm unclear about, because I can see in a traumatized system these kinds of things happen, and then you say the structures weren't in place. The places where I've been working, they have structures, but because of fears of the race card fears of a lot of other things, the structures are the union versus man, whatever, there's structures all over the place. But I don't know what you mean by structures not in place rather than the emotional issues not work. It seems to be a different thing from what you were saying earlier. So that's where I'm getting confused. What structures do you mean and what do you mean by structures not in place?
No, I think you're making a valid point. When I say structures, I often think that a structure includes the capacity for it to work. If you say there's a rule and then there's no accountability, I say the structure doesn't work. There is no structure. If you don't have any accountability, you can put rules on the table from now until.
I think you could probably address it in another way, in that employees are very educated to where the fault lines are.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the fault lines that you talk about. So the structures weren't capable of dealing with those fault lines. Mm-hmm. They knew exactly where those fault lines were.
Absolutely.
So then it doesn't have to be race. It could be any other kind of stuff.
That's correct.
But that accountability stuff there is where the fault line is, or the lack of.
I'm going to get both of you in a second. The other thing that you're saying is that what happens for me in the traumatized system is that the system defaults to the informal,
right,
and that's where the action is. That's what drives things. People say this is what the organizational structure is, but it's the informal system that really runs it. And that's based on emotions and assumptions, and it's harder for people to get a handle on that. Go ahead.
The thing that's this does sound very familiar, and the thing that's striking to me about these systems, and that's so tricky about them, is that the simple exercise of authority re-traumatizes the system. Because the experience of trauma usually happens at the hands of an authority figure in some way, or an authority structure. And so the simple exercise, even if it's good authority, even if it is structured, re-traumatizes the system and it spins out of control.
That's correct.
And that makes it really almost impossible, I think, to change these systems.
Well, it's extraordinarily difficult, because it's very much like dealing with a trauma survivor. If they've been violated and abused, and you raise your voice, they'll say, "You're abusing me."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or the same thing happens in the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. Then somebody else had a hand up over there.
What is the correlate to accountability in the individual with trauma?
Oh, that's an excellent question.
What's the question?
What is the correlate to accountability in the traumatized individual? Because we were using the individual, the traumatized individual as an analogous to get to the organization as a trauma. So when you say accountability is not there, I'm thinking that in the individual who is traumatized, what is the correlate to that accountability that is not functioning?
Well, I think you have the same you point to the same problem.
I think that the individual cannot take charge. A traumatized individual cannot take charge any longer, or having a hard time taking charge of their own life.
Well, I think that there's a lot of emotional stuff that's underneath that the traumatized individual has a hard time working with if they don't feel safe or secure enough to take risks or getting the kind of support and help to do it. I think the organization runs into a similar pattern, that the real issue is that once the trauma is in the system, everybody knows that you can't rely on, you can't depend on. And so people organize themselves in their little territories, in their own world. They do whatever they can do to stay safe enough so they don't get caught. Well, the problem with that is that there's no movement, there's no expansion, no work going on. It's almost, this has a very as-if quality, and work is painful. And so until you repair the environment, and the same for the trauma person. People who have a history of it, usually don't get well unless they're in an environment or a relationship that they feel safe enough to risk doing what they need to do to improve the new behavior. Well, that creates a lot of demand on some system for that to happen. And that's also the problem with the organization. So you have to really have a commitment somewhere at the top to do the kind of work that's going to make a difference. And one of my cases really deals with that one.
Can you give some examples of what causes an organization to be traumatized?
Well, I can... What causes an organization to be traumatized? There's a lot to that one. But I'll give you an example. This was a union organization. And the union had been in it 30, 40 years. And the pattern that was set was that the union was the power force. And that in order for anything to happen, they had to work through the negotiations that they went through every so often, and every so often it got nasty and ugly. And the pattern in the organization is when they had a nasty strike, even after the strike was resolved, usually took 5, 6 years, 7 years before people could calm down. That's a long time. Now, that means that they're negotiating contracts about every 3 years. So around about the next second or the third encounter around the contract ends, and they start right where they were before. And what happens in the negotiations is the union pulls all out. They come from a fight place that says the only way to survive is to win the fight. Win. Not compromise. Win. So management is constantly faced with, you know, how do we do this? And you can't do it at the time that the negotiations occur. You have to do the work before. Now, they don't train managers. There's no consistent management, you know, structure or pattern. The whole evolution about, you know, moving toward collaborative work doesn't get in there, because most of the managers that come in and get in the roles don't understand anything about it. And so a few do it, a few don't. But basically, it's a win-lose fight. So... And then the managers that come in from the line. They come out of the union, and they move up. And so the unofficial agreement is you don't enforce. You don't hold the ground here. We were your friends. You know, where's your loyalty? Oh, it's ugly. And so the whole system is driven by the unspoken agreement about win-lose. And nobody wants to lose. So there's this undertow of distrust, abuse, the things that go on in those negotiations. They assault people's families. They go after them on the picket lines. They threaten lives. It's ugly. So there's a frightening environment that's underneath. So for a manager to stand up and say, I'm going to do my job and hold people accountable, you know, they come after them. And if there are no managers that are willing to hold the ground with you that you can feel held by or supported by, so your managers are all walking around in hypervigilance. All of them. And when it comes to a fight, they look around and say, who's behind me? That's the system. It took me almost 2.5 years to get the senior managers to take up their roles, because if they weren't going to take up their roles, nobody beneath them was going to do it.
So by accountability means taking up roles?
That's a piece of being accountable, yes.
Not getting punished. You don't mean, right. You don't mean by accountable, you don't mean get punished.
No.
Taking up
your role. And taking it up responsibly and with integrity, holding your ground. But you see, the problem that I see in this work is that you can't do it by going in and saying there's some traditional skills that you should have, you know, be a good manager. This is what a good manager does. Hell, what a good manager does. This is a war zone you're in. They need to understand, how do I first survive and take care of me? You know, how do I understand the mess and what's happened here? And how do I create safe space so people can work? Now, if you can't create it at the level that your peers are working, how are you going to create it for the people who are your subordinates?
And then the organization needs to create time for mourning, too.
Oh, absolutely. Did you say mourning? M-O-U-R-N? I couldn't agree with you more. There is no appreciation for the pain. Well, now you've snatched up my case, and you're right on. So let me just go join you with the story. So what, for me, I discovered is that, first, you have to create safety. Now, what I've learned over the years is that you can't create safety unless you're willing to take risks. Because if you lose the first round, getting it back is twice as hard. Sometimes you don't. So one of the things I know is that if you're going to make it safe, they're going to come and test and see. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to trust that because you said it's safe. So what they do is they find all kinds of ways to come after you. You say, and I need you to be in the room so we can talk about real issues. So somebody tests whether talking is going to be safe. They'll start saying something critical about the boss. Now you're in a tight spot because you can't sit there and say, oh yeah, badmouth the guy. On the other hand, if you don't give them permission to talk, they're going to say you're part of them and you've lost your job. So, what do you think you do? Instead of me telling you, let me hear what the thinking is.
Probably keep the conversation not focused on the individual, but more on the system as a whole. So, nothing becomes personal. We're just talking about, hey, what do we see within the system, the processes and the procedures that aren't working properly.
Okay, I agree with you. But now watch the test. Let's say you were doing that, and I'm in the room and say, you're a sorry son of a bitch. You really are in the camp of the other guy. Why the hell should we listen to you? You're just another one of those damn consultants that come in here. You don't want to tell us what to do. Now, when are you leaving, by the way? How long are you going to be here? Well, let me hear what you're going to say to that.
I'd probably ask the question. Let's make him say that.
That's what I'm going to say. I don't like your sorry ass. Now, what are you going to do about that? Okay.
I would probably ask him, you know, why has it got to this level? Why is it like?
Doesn't work. You see, this is the learning story. The invitation, see, in somebody wrote some time ago that in any battle between the adult and the child always wins. If you don't know how to get out of playing the adult-child game, or the parent-child game, because what they invite you to do is do the parent beat, keep them in check. And if you do, they got you. So that's just one of the traps. So you've got to create a safe environment. You've got to create it on their ground. So you've got to create a way for them to talk about what? What is it they most need to say? Think about trauma people. What is it they most need to be able to talk about?
Their trauma.
Their feelings, their trauma, their pain. Trauma survivors are in pain. The organization's in pain. And one of the mistakes that I think we make is going in trying to fix it before we demonstrate that we understand it. And so you've got to give them the room to talk about their pain. Now, the risk with that is that you can't do therapy in there. So you don't want them dissolving down into their woundedness and have that spilling all over the room, because now you got to clean that up. That's another way to get booted out of there. So you've got to create something that allows them to talk about their pain. And what I discovered is that the gambit is to really pay attention to how do you link with their experience without getting lost in it with them. And so I started doing things in that group. I started doing the management meetings. I said, the deal I made is, let me have the management meeting. The only time all those managers got in the same room was in the managers meeting. There were about 20 of them in the room. I said, let me have them for 6 months. I said, I won't take them for anything less. So I had the management meeting for the first 6 months that I came in. And I came in and I told them, first meeting, I told them my story. I have a way of telling my story that links with some of their experience. The next thing I did was I started doing things that helped them to look at the pain in the room. I said, you know, this has got to be a painful experience for all of you. You should have seen the room change when I said that. I said, you know, it cannot be a pleasant experience. And then they started talking about that, yeah, this was painful. And so that led to my being able to use metaphors, stories, and conversation to open up the dialogue. Metaphors had to do with linking their experience with something that they could understand. So, for example, some of you have seen Cartman's Drama Triangle, where he talks about the three roles that go on, which is victim, rescuers, and persecutors. Well, tell me, that's not the world they're living in. And they relate to that immediately. And so they start talking about how they feel like victims, where they see the game being played, what part they see management has, what part they see themselves having. And you go on from there. I use parent-child-adult patterns, because immediately they get the connection. So you can tell them that your pain, and when you're busy, you know, beating people up and punishing them, that's exactly what kids do. Any of you got adolescents? Story's on. And I love talking about my adolescents. So they will talk. It took me about 3 sessions. Never failed. About the 3rd or 4th session, people were weeping in the room. The pain is right here. And they'll ask you to either, you know, defend yourself. That's why I went after you. I just showed you. Because that's what they'll do. They'll go and attack you because they're hurting. And if you either fight back or disappear, they got you. And so you got to stay out of the crossfire. And then they'll work. Took us about 6 meetings, and then they gave you that list I showed you about what the under-the-table issues was that came from that. And you look at those under-the-table issues, you see what kind of pain they were in. Can't trust management. The place isn't safe. You know, you don't get rewarded for anything you do well. Jesus Christmas. So that's the answer to that question. And so safety also means that if you are working your group, you have to hold the space. So what you'll see is that they not only come after you and you have to manage that, but they go after each other. They attack, they don't listen, they violate. So you've got to hold the space. The 3rd place they test you is with the boss. I always get my exec in that room as soon as possible with me in it. And I know what's going to happen. They're going to show their butts and see what's going to happen. And I get him ready. I say, you know, this is going to happen and so forth. And so we go through that whole thing. And they find out whether I'm going to hold accountable or whether I'm going to side with the exec. They need to see what my neutrality looks like. And they need to know that I will tell him to hold on, don't get in that, and that he'll listen. And once they know I can do that with the boss in the room, they'll work. And the boss can do whatever she needs. And at some point, they'll start talking to him. The problem you have is that the original violation that happens to them is internalized. And then you have to get it out so that they can work it before they'll work with the authority figure that is the object of their humiliation. And a lot of it's projection on him, but it doesn't matter. It's real because that's what's happening.
So it sounds like there's a trust issue between the exec and his staff.
Is the direct report? Their direct reports.
I'm still not clear on how you were able to really bridge that gap? Is it something that you're doing behind the scenes with the exec, or is everything
around the open? Yes, I am working with the exec behind the scenes. I won't go in near it until I have an understanding with the exec. I won't touch it unless he is in agreement about what I'm going to do, and he supports and backs it up, or she. Nothing less. I'm not going in unless I have that. I can't. The bottom line is the exec got the last say, and they can either get you killed or make sure you are successful. So if you don't have a trust relationship, I've walked away from agencies because I don't have enough of a relationship with the exec. I can't do the work. It's too dangerous. You get hurt. I'm serious. If you don't get yourself emotionally hurt, you can get physically hurt if you don't have a sense of where the boundaries are in the system. In a system that doesn't have boundaries already. Are you crazy? Or you don't want to go ahead and do that?
So how can we get this nation go through mourning and stop attacking other countries?
You ask wonderful questions. I love your questions. I don't always have the answer. I think that's a wonderful question.
Say it again from the mic. What did you say?
Say it again.
Then how can we get this nation go through mourning and stop attacking other countries?
How do we get the nation to go through mourning and stop attacking other countries? He took it to it. He took it to another level. Go ahead, Heather.
I mean, the thing that I'm hearing in the examples is not just trauma in the organization, but people bringing to larger system trauma with them and then reenacting it in the organization. So it seems to me that there's at least a piece of the conversation that has to deal with that. So the race baiting, that piece, I hear a larger conversation about racism and how it gets internalized, enacted, made fearful, etc., and then gets used within the trauma of the organization to also then play on whatever the dynamics are of that organization.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, with the unions, I hear issues of class and economics, and right, there's a whole host of other dynamics that people bring into the organization with them. So I'm curious about how or if any of that gets addressed.
Well, I think what you're hearing from me is what I call the person role issue. Mm-hmm. When the stress is in the organization, the roles have to get clear more than that's the most important. Now, the persons that are in those roles, you know, are often in pain and need some, but that can't be my primary job, because I think you're off task then. I think if the assessment was that the trauma is just in people and you're running a hospital, that's one thing. This is an organization that's got a task, so you've got to stay on that. And then you are supportive of people individually as a side piece. I'm very caring. People will come up afterwards and say, I'm hurting. And you know, I'll stop and listen and talk and give them some suggestions about places to go. But, you know, they asked me in there to heal the system. And that's bigger than just any one individual. And it's really hard because, you know, your heart goes out to some of these people. I recently, it's about 2 years ago, I recently did an organization that had 20 years of being violated and abused. Do you hear me? 20 years. They were a residential treatment facility. And the exec that had been running it ran it with an iron fist, kept his hands on the till. Nobody was permitted to do anything that he didn't approve of. The other person who was in control was the financial guy, and the two of them were in collusion. And it's still not clear all the crap that they did that was under the table. But the result was that everybody who worked in the agency had adapted a survival stance, and they were masterful at it. Let me tell you some of the ugly things we found when we got there. We found a residential, this is just one example, a residential staffer, and I'm telling you, just one, a bunch of them were doing versions of this, that had contracts with the kids, that if she couldn't control a particular kid, she let somebody, one of the tougher kids in the place, control her. So the kid had permission to kick somebody else's ass until that person got in line. And that's how he got his rewards, and that, I'm serious, this is no makeup. That's just one. Another one had her own barbecue business going on grounds. She had, and she, you know, worked fine because the exec and the businessman, you know, were buying some of her stuff. So the supervisor of the cottage wasn't going to say anything to her. What's going on right under your nose? I'm just thinking of the more outrageous ones. That's what I walked in on. When I came in, the person who had just taken over was, you know, a former trainee of mine that had been head of the clinical system, and but she had sat on it for a year. She called me a year before that and said, "I think I would love to get you in if I can't get you in." I said, "No, don't bring me in there until you're in charge. I don't want nothing to do with it. Not what I hear with that guy." So she brought me in about a month after she got in there. And the interviews that I did with the staff were heartbreaking. The HR woman wept, walked into my interview and wept for 40 minutes. I couldn't get much in. She was in so much pain. She'd been abused. Abused. The guy who was supposed to be raising money for the system, he hadn't raised any money for 15 years. And he was running around having parties with the exec. They were buddies. He'd come in, put his feet up on the table. There wasn't any money getting raised. Now, they happened to have had a good endowment, which probably was what kept them, you know, alive. But when I got in there, the grounds was the most important priority of the last exec. The grounds were gorgeous. But what was going on in those houses was a sin and a crime. 3 years it's taken me to get it back. 3 years.
Could you give a sense of how you prepare your team to enter a toxic system like you described?
He said examples of how you get the team prepared to enter a toxic system like that. Well, in that case, just very quickly, we're about to run out of time, but quickly, I was the main person entering. My team was behind me. And they, you know, I'd bring the stuff. They do the work on materials. Because we were doing two levels. We were doing the interventions, and we were doing the... And I couldn't do anything until I got to see the management team. It took me the better part of the first year to get the management team back on their feet. Now, these people have been in the place for 15 years and 20 years. Do you know what I'm dealing with? They're as much the problem as everybody else. So the question was, who was going to stay and who was going to go? And you couldn't go in and just throw everybody out unless you were going to close the whole building down, the whole thing down, and start from scratch. And they chose not to do that. So, but people were traumatized. Every level we had to shift. And what I said to them was, I said, this is not a physical, technical journey. It's an emotional journey. And I said, unless I can't even tell you I can get the accountability stuff in until I get through the first year.
In that case, who called you in?
She did. The exec. I wouldn't have gone anywhere near it. The exec didn't call me in.
Have you ever, in these situations, oftentimes you're called in because there's one person that's causing all the problems, allegedly?
No.
I'm just asking. That's a situation I've been involved in sometimes. And do you feel is the message, part of the message of what you're saying, that the system is so traumatized, the organization is so traumatized, that it's not going to be any one person? In the sense that oftentimes there'll be this story going on, this narrative in the organization. If that one person and that other person weren't here, everything would be great.
Yeah. And it's a story.
Yeah.
That's almost never true. Now, there are places where the system may not be as traumatized, and that there may be more you know, located, you know, particular characters. But more often than not, there's stuff going on there that allows those characters to exist.
Right.
And that's what makes it tough. I don't know where the time went. It's just 6:30 already, and that's my time, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've enjoyed talking to you. I hope this was helpful. I didn't even get to. And two of the cases that I thought would have you dancing out of your chair, I didn't even get to. But I've enjoyed working with you. I guess I need to honor the boundary. I don't know what else is going on. So does anybody have any quick questions that they need to ask before I get out of here?
Are your slides going to be available?
I can get, if you want me to give you a copy of this particular set of slides, leave me your email address. What you'll find on the back of them is all of my suggestions about what responsible leadership behavior under stress and crisis looks like. And it's all there. Lots of fun.